We're hearing an album titled Early American Roots, and we're told by the ensemble Hesperus that the album presents a cross-section of popular American instrumental music from before and just after the American Revolution. The same instruments that were popular in England in the 17th and 18th centuries accompanied settlers to North America. Recorders and flageolets made excellent solo instruments and could be transported in a pocket. The hammered dulcimer required more space, but a dedicated musician found room for it on the first ship to Jamestown in 1607. The violin, the most common instrument for dancing, and the more private viol, viola da gamba, were favorite instruments on both sides of the Atlantic. There is superb solo music for the viol, such as the compositions of Tobias Hume, who was a retired sea captain. The cittern, a popular instrument from Elizabethan and later times, often hung in barber shops for customers to play upon. Music was used for both private amusement and public entertainment and reflected the cultural differences between colonial North and South. Southern colonists tried to replicate the gracious life of English country manors. Plantations often employed full-time dancing masters so that residents should not, quote, revert to barbarism in the wilderness. One 18th century traveler to the New World noted that the ladies of Virginia were immoderately fond of dancing. In contrast, the Puritans in New England at first prohibited dancing, but eventually succumbed to its appeal. Dance music has always been an oral tradition. Musicians played and passed along their tunes by ear. Nonetheless, publishers in the 17th and 18th centuries found a large market for printed music among amateur musicians. The English Dancing Master was first published by John Playford in 1651 and reprinted many times by his son, Henry. It is our most extensive source of English country dance tunes. Apollo's Banquet for the Treble Violin was a collection of dance tunes from the latter part of the 17th century. In America, another family of publishers, the Brothers Carr, imported Playford prints and published many of their own collections, including the first book of cotillions on this side of the Atlantic, that from the ensemble Hesperus, describing the cross-pollination of music across the Atlantic, one way mostly, in the 17th and 18th centuries. This year that marks the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence also marks the 50th anniversary of the early music program at Moravian University in Bethlehem, founded and directed to this day by Larry Lipkius, who is Starner Professor of Music and Composer in Residence at Moravian. And Dr. Lipkius has assembled quite a celebration to mark that anniversary, and it will take place Saturday, April 11th at 4 o'clock in Pater Hall on the campus of Moravian in the Lehigh Valley in Bethlehem. And we had a chance to speak with Larry Lipkius by phone about the history of the early music program at Moravian and his own passion for early music.
I actually began playing early music shortly after my brother gave me a recorder as a graduation present from high school. And I just played little popular songs out until I was a freshman at UCLA, and I went to a concert of early music there. And I saw people playing the recorder, and I thought, wow, I could be in that group with my recorder. And that's really where it began. That would have been in the late 60s, early 70s. And so it just blossomed from there. I joined a little splinter group from the main group. And then when I went to graduate school, I played in early music ensembles there. I took up the viola da gamba and other interesting Renaissance wind instruments like crumhorns and gemshorns. And then when I came to Moravian in 1975, I began with working with some students in early music. And then the following year, 76, I started what is known as the Collegium Musicum, which is a very old term and really just refers to a group of amateur musicians, usually affiliated with an academy of some kind. And interestingly, Bach led a group called the Collegium Musicum when he was in Leipzig for over 10 years. So we started that, and that was always a mix of students and faculty and staff and community members. So we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of that group. But in the intervening years, I added several other ensembles. I added the mostly Monteverdi ensemble known as the Montes in 1993, just an all-vocal group. And then the Baroque ensemble in 2006, a group of people who play these exotic wind instruments, crumhorns and gemshorns. We call that WIRE, standing for Weird Instrument Renaissance Ensemble. That was in 2015. And professionally, I play with the Baltimore Consort, and we are still at it after 45 years or so. That's really been a great joy in my life to be with that ensemble for that long. I've made many recordings and still travel around and tour. So that's sort of my early music life, and I'm just kind of celebrating it, at least with my experience at Moravian University coming up on April 11th.
Larry, before we get to the event, the fact that you started in 75, 76, what was the state of early music overall? What was happening in America in those days?
Well, I think the most important group back then was the New York Pro Musica, and they were kind of foundational. A lot of us younger, you know, the students looked up to this ensemble, and they made some recordings. And when I was an undergraduate at UCLA, we did have a collegium musicum. And I think in the 50s and into the 60s, there were burgeoning groups. And then I think it kind of took off because people found this music to be very enjoyable, fun to play, and fun to listen to. And the recorder has had a kind of renaissance since really the beginning of the 20th century. And so I think, you know, my experience really comes from my early years as a student at UCLA. And I think that there was at that point, we just really felt things were beginning to take off in the early music. It was quite exciting. There were a lot of groups coming over from Europe that we enjoyed listening to. So I felt we were kind of at the beginning of a very exciting movement.
And do you have classes for the students, or is this something that's just part of their overall study program, that they're part of the Collegium and the Montes and so forth? How does that work at the school?
Well, these are just called small ensembles. The students at Moravian in the music department would take, they would be in a large ensemble, such as the orchestra, maybe the marching band, the big band, wind ensemble, and then they can take small ensembles as well. It could be a string quartet. It could be a jazz combo. And this is where the early music program is situated. We are called small ensembles. So students often take one, two, or three of them in addition to their main ensemble.
You have been adding various ensembles as the time has passed. So that would suggest that you're never at a lack in terms of student interest.
No, I generally am not. What I do is I bring down all of my Renaissance instruments, including my viola da gamba, different sizes. I have a lute, all my recorders, crumhorns and gemshorns. I bring it down to the class, which is for sophomores, where they learn about Renaissance music, medieval Renaissance music. I do a little show and tell. And the first time I did it, there was just a wave of interest in the crumhorn. This was in 2015, and there were 12 people who wanted to play crumhorn. So I had to scrape up 12 crumhorns. I owned about six of them. So I begged and borrowed. I didn't steal any, but I borrowed a bunch of them so that we could have an ensemble of 12 crumhorns. That was quite something. And then we had an ensemble of more modest of six, and now we have four, which I think is a very good size for a lot of reasons. But we can play music in four parts, of which there's plenty, and it's easier to stay in tune if we don't have multiple players on all the parts. So I think, you know, when I introduce the students and their sophomore year, there's usually a lot of interest. People say, I want to play this. And one of the treats, one thing that we always do or have been doing for many years is at Christmas time, we take our crumhorns and we decorate them because crumhorns look like candy canes, sort of brown candy canes. So we decorate them, we trim them like you trim a tree. And then we learn some Christmas carols and we go to the Hotel Bethlehem and play in the lobby. We go to St. Luke's Hospital and play in the children's ward. And it's really fun because we have little bells and all sorts of things attached to the crumhorns. So they look great and kids are very entranced by them. And here we are playing Christmas carols, Good King Wenceslas, etc. So that's something that's very appealing to the students. So we do that in the fall. And then when we can, we get them together in the spring to also play in the Early Music Spring Concert.
Well, when you knew this 50th anniversary was approaching, what did you think about doing and how did you think about marking the occasion?
Well, as it happens, it coincided with the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. So a lot of groups are recognizing that in their programming. It's just everywhere. People are celebrating America's birth. So I thought, well, look, that was in 1776. That was really pretty much in the early music sphere. We usually play music a little bit earlier than that. We do go into the Baroque, but most of our music is in the Renaissance period. So, you know, around 1450 to 1600, then we go into the early 17th centuries. So we're stretching out a little bit. So what I decided to do, sort of in honor of this anniversary of the country's birth, was to focus on colonial era music from England and America, which is something we'd never done before. So it introduced me to some new repertoire as well, which I always enjoy. I called the colonial era going all the way back to the Jamestown settlement in 1607. That opened up, you know, a whole new, we're not just restricting it to the Declaration of Independence eras, we're going back further. So now we can use music from the early 17th century, which is wonderful music for the early music ensembles.
Give us a sense of what you have settled on and how that tribute to not just to the anniversary of the program at Moravian, but to the country at large.
Sure. So we're going to start with colonial era music from England, and we're starting with a piece called a canzone, which is a contrapuntal work for five voices, a very stirring, lively piece by William Brady, who was born in England. He had most of his professional life in Germany, and they call him Wilhelm Brade over there, but we're considering him to be English. So this is from the early 17th century. And then we're doing a little song by Henry Purcell, who is one of our favorite composers. It's called If Love's a Sweet Passion, and we're involving all the groups except Wire. We're holding off on them. But this is from Purcell's opera, The Fairy Queen. It's a really beautiful chorus. Then we introduce the Wire folks with their Gemshorns and Crumhorns, and we do some English country dances published by the English writer and publisher John Playford from 1651. So this is where the audience gets to experience these unusual sounding instruments. The Gemshorn is the horn of a wild goat, and it has a very warm, mellow, flute-like sound. The Crumhorn is a double reed instrument, and that has more of a nasal sound. It's a double reed like an oboe or bassoon, but the reed is capped, so the lips don't actually touch the reed. It's a very charming sound. So we have two dances that are going to feature those two instruments. Then we're going to do something very interesting. We're doing a piece by Christian Ignatius Latrobe, who is a Moravian minister in England. He never actually came to America, though he had relatives who lived in Pennsylvania. And his works are found in the Moravian Music Archives here in Bethlehem. So we thought we'd include him. And we have our keyboard player perform one of his movements from a sonata in A major. He was actually a good friend of Haydn's. So we're kind of moving a little bit into the classical era with Latrobe. Then we're going to do a piece by Henry Purcell's younger brother, Daniel, who's also a fine composer, who also wrote theatrical music and courtly music. So we're going to do a trio sonata. It's quite a fine work. And then we're going to conclude the English part of this program with a piece, a very funny piece called Push About the Brisk Bull. This is by William Boyce, who is a very well-established composer associated with the court. He was admired by people like Handel and others of that era. Normally a very sober fellow, but in this case, he's writing a very funny piece. in the words of a group of commoners who are sitting on a lawn outside of a tavern, and they're singing verses, kind of making fun in a rude way of high society folks like doctors and lawyers and merchants. And it's not vulgar exactly, but getting into that into that realm. So we're acting that out, because one thing the Montys, the Monteverdi Ensemble, like to do is do at least one theatrical number per show. And so this is the one. And it's quite charming. It's kind of fun to imagine William Boyce sort of taking off his wig and just having fun with music for commoners. So then we switch over to colonial music from America. We're focusing on the English composers who had roots in England, but they were living in America. And we're starting with someone who's not very well known at all. His name was Timothy Swan. He's not a professional composer. In fact, there were very few professional composers in the colonial era at the time of the Revolution. He was actually a hat maker by trade, but he did write a lot of hymns. Mostly the composers in that time were writing hymns, choral music, and he wrote a really lovely song called Lute String, and so that's just a choral work. Then we have two pieces by William Billings, who is probably the most well-known colonial era American composer, and these are two of his most well-known works. One is called David's Lamentation, which is a setting of texts from 2 Samuel about King David, and he also wrote a work called Chester. And Chester was a very, very popular Revolutionary War song where the verses make fun of the English generals who are being beaten up by the beardless boys of America. So it's a very, it's a kind of a satire, but it was very, it's very stirring. And for a while, it was actually thought of as America's national anthem until the Star Spangled Banner came along. So it was that popular. It was done in churches and schools, everywhere. Very, very popular patriotic song. And some composers like William Schumann have written their own versions of it in the 20th century. Then we have something very interesting. It's a campaign song from the year 1800 about the election between Thomas Jefferson and Adams. And there are many, many verses. We're only doing four, but some of the verses are very scathing about England. And the others are very patriotically set texts about how wonderful America is and how welcoming America is. So it has some, I think the last verse we're doing goes, here, meaning America, here strangers from a thousand shores compelled by tyranny to roam shall find amidst abundant stores a nobler and a happier home. So it's kind of welcoming message to immigrants, a little bit like what we find on the Statue of Liberty. Bring me your tired, your poor, you know, your homeless. So it's in that spirit. So we felt that was very appropriate. That's going to have a little sing-along element as well for the audience. And then we end the first half with a toast to General Washington by Francis Hopkinson, who was actually one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence representing New Jersey. But he's also a fine composer and harpsichordist. So this is a very rousing little toast to General. He wasn't president yet, so it's just to General Washington.
This campaign song titled Jefferson and Liberty, we understand that Thomas Jefferson was quite an aficionado, a music lover, and had...
He was.
Can you tell us something about... Because he did believe very much that music should be part of people's education.
He did. He had a lot of instruments in the home. His daughter played harpsichord very well. And a friend of mine did a whole program on music from Jefferson's home, music that might have been performed in Monticello, and this piece comes from that. He also loved Scottish music. And this particular song sounds like a Scottish folk song, but the words are very patriotically American. So it's kind of interesting because he just loved really music of all kinds, and he had many soirees in his home, probably the most musical of all presidents in that era. You're absolutely right. He wanted music to be a part of everyone's life. And he tried to model that, I guess, for the American citizens. So in the second half, what we've done in the past, and this is beginning in the year 1996, we've had anniversary gatherings. So at the 20-year anniversary, we invited alums who have either been alums of Moravian, it was college back then, or just simply alums of the early music program, to come back and play with the current members of the early music ensembles. And we've been doing that every 5 years, 25, 30, 35, 40. We had to skip 45 because of the pandemic, but here we are at 50. So we've had people coming back to play from the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. It's really great fun because we have a little luncheon beforehand so they can meet each other and then they gather. We have a rehearsal, and then we fill the stage in the second half with all these alums from all these different decades playing together with our current students. So it makes the stage a little crowded, but it's really, really fun. And we have some pieces we do traditionally every 5 years. We just do the same pieces, and some people who come back really enjoy that experience. And we begin with music for the children and grandchildren of the alums. And we call them the Collegium Kids. And they're two traditional pieces. So I think we have three kids who are under 1 year of age, like they're 10, 11 months old. So they're going to be up there too with their little rattles in their parents' arms. But this is something we do. It's a lovely tradition, great fun for the parents and the children that can go from, 8 months to 18 years. So we start with that. And then the Monteverdi group from last year was a very tight group. They were in the ensemble for all 4 years of their time, and they wanted to have a madrigal of their own. So we are doing a piece called All Creatures Now, which is a famous madrigal from a collection called The Triumphs of Oriana, all written in honor of Queen Elizabeth, whose nickname was Oriana. So we're going to have them start it, and then the alums are going to join in the little refrain at the very end. And then we're going to go to a song in honor of St. George, the patron saint of England. And this is by Henry Purcell again, who lived in the latter part of the 17th century. It's one we do every year. It's a very rousing song, really fun to sing with instruments and voices. We're going to reprise the song by Francis Hopkinson called A Toast to General Washington. So the alums will sing this, and then the audience members will come in on the refrain. So there's a lot of singing. You don't have to sing, of course, if you're in the audience, but you were invited to. We have some dances that were very popular. We're not, in this second half, we're not sticking to the colonial era. So we're going back a little bit into the Renaissance with some pieces for the instrumentalists. And then we have four pieces to end that we do almost every 5 years. One is a little balletto from the 1500s. So ben mi cabo in tempo. It's a very silly little song, kind of gossipy with a lot of nonsense words, but it's fun. Then we do a piece by Josquin des Prez, who lived in the early part of the 16th century. El Grillo, this is about a cricket. And in this song, Josquin is saying he, unlike some of his fellow composers, he is loyal to his patron. He doesn't run off. He compares himself to a cricket who stays where he is, unlike the birds who sing and then they fly away. The cricket is loyal. So we always do that when we have little cricket clickers to help make the point.
Come lì, ha cantato poco, ma ne fa in altro luogo.
have a little Galician folk song called Baila Nena, which has a lovely text. Dance, little girl, because the stars in the sky are already dancing for you. And we always bring on a little girl, a child dancer, a little girl who is, you know, 10 or 11 or 12, and she does a little dance to this music. That's also a tradition. And we end with this really wild piece called Das Bleut zu Speyer by Ludwig Zenfel from the 16th century. And this, it means the bell, the sounds of bells from Speyer, which was a cathedral town on the Rhine River. And this kind of puts us all inside the bell tower, and people are singing sounds that the bells might make, like kling, klang, murr, maun, like that. And then there's some frantic German exhortations to the bell ringers to ring faster and louder. And the audience is involved in that too. They get to sing the gling long. We have bells. It's really a lot of fun. We just do it every 5 years, and it's a lot of fun. Then, for people who have energy left, we take a little break, and then we have some Renaissance and English country dancing. So after a short intermission, we remove the benches from Pater Hall. We invite the audience to stay and learn some dances, the country dances from France, like a branle, and then a courtly dance, a ballet, and then some English country dances, the Indian Queen and Selinger's Round. So this is going to be a huge event as far as music and entertainment. So the audience members should come prepared to do some singing and dancing. All of that, of course, is optional. You can just come and listen and enjoy the music and not sing and dance, but you are encouraged to do so.
And Larry, just again, a little explanation, because often we've talked over the years of your concerts, and dance has been integral to the programs that you do. Tell us a little bit about the culture, the societies, depending on the country. Social dancing was really important.
It was very important, and we emphasize it a lot, going all the way back to the art of courtly behavior. Lots of literature was written about you really need to learn how to dance in order to be a person of worth. And so there are treatises about that. There are books about country dancing. There are books about courtly dancing. So we really emphasize dance in a lot of our programs. And often I've had a dance component where I teach the simple dances to the audience members. But a lot of the music I choose, whether we dance it or not, is based on dance rhythms and dance patterns. And you can find that throughout music, even if it's a sacred work, it has a dance rhythm to it. Bach, for example, might write an aria that might be in the rhythm of a sarabande, for example. And he knew exactly what he was doing, because the sarabande had a particular quality about it that evoked tenderness and pathos, perhaps. And so composers knew, they grew up with these dances. Bach, when he was young, a teenager, played in the court orchestra in a town called Celle in northern Germany. So he knew all these French dances, and he just incorporated them oftentimes in his music, which was not really meant to be danced. In fact, could be a sacred piece. So he's not the only one who did that, of course, but he's a very good model to look at. So many pieces. For example, even the very first piece in the program that is sung by Henry Purcell, If Love's a Sweet Passion, it's in the rhythm of a Galliardo, Renaissance dance. So we find it everywhere, and it's joyful to and when you tell the students how to play this according to the dance rhythms, the music makes a lot more sense often.
Can you tell us how we can join in this celebration?
Right. Well, it's on April 11th, which is a Saturday, coming up pretty soon. So you just come to Pater Hall at Moravian University. It's the Church Street campus on the second floor. There's a parking lot. If it's overflowed, there's parking across the street. I would say get there early if you could. And it's at 4 o'clock, and then we'll probably go to about 5:15, 5:30, and then the dancing will happen. The dancing won't be very long. There'll just be 3 or 4 pieces. So it should end by 6. So I would encourage anybody who wants to hear this stirring, often comic sometimes, beautifully moving at other times, all this music from the colonial era and then traditional works, some of the favorites of our players from the alumni, come to our concert and enjoy it. And if you want to sing along to the rousing songs of the revolutionary era, this is a great opportunity to do so.
Larry Lipkus, Starner Professor of Music and Composer in Residence at Moravian University in Bethlehem, speaking with us about the 50th anniversary early music concert on Saturday, April 11th at 4 o'clock in the afternoon at Pater Hall on the Moravian University campus in Bethlehem. The event marks the 50th anniversary of the founding by Dr. Lipkus of the early music program at Moravian. And as we heard, there will be music from the English country dance tradition and much more music from, for example, Francis Hopkinson, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, who wrote a toast to George Washington, and much more. For more information on the web, moravian.edu, moravian.edu. That's the 50th anniversary early music concert presented on Saturday, April 11th at 4 in the afternoon at Pater Hall on the Church Street campus of Moravian University in Bethlehem. For more information on the web, moravian.edu, moravian.edu.